it's Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, a Manhattan truck attack kills 8 people in the worst act of terror in New York City since 9/11. A new Fed chair is announced, a new tax plan takes shape, and NPR's top editor resigns after accusations of sexual harassment. Also, the announcement of the first criminal charges in the Russia investigation. On Thursday, I talked with Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush of the New York Times to help make sense of what the charges mean and where the investigation might go from here.
But anybody who's watched Law and Order or seen a procedural in the movie theater knows that you start with the lower level folks and you move your way towards the center.
Then,
what does it mean about American justice that the profit motive is such a big part of the justice system?
It looked like private prisons were on the way out under President Obama. Now, under President Trump, the industry is seeing a resurgence. But first, joining me by phone from their respective offices, Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush. Glenn and Maggie, how great to talk with you both again.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Maggie, bring us up to date on the latest in the Mueller investigation. I mean, we've heard the names Paul Manafort, we've heard Rick Gates, we've heard George Papadopoulos. Tell us what's going on now.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess I come at this from a different end, which is that I don't actually think that we know a ton more than we did before Monday when these indictments started dropping. We knew that Manafort was going to be indicted. We did not know the breadth of criminal conduct he was going to be accused of. But his deputy, you know, was hand in glove with him, and that was not a surprise, Rick Gates being the deputy. George Papadopoulos was the surprise, less because he's a central figure. But I would say two things, and there was some very good reporting in the Washington Post about this months ago. He puts the lie to the idea that this went nowhere near the campaign. He was a campaign aide, and he was charged with and pleaded guilty to lying to federal investigators. The belief is that he is cooperating with the investigation. What he told lies about related to his work with the campaign, and there was a meeting during which he suggested the president meet with Vladimir Putin, and that was, you know, a pretty significant moment at the time. How that was handled, I think, is we are still reporting out, trying to understand. But what you can see is an investigation that, as we hurtle toward the holidays, is beginning to grind down a little more deeply on the campaign. How deeply into the campaign it gets, we don't know, but we do know that a number of White House officials have already been interviewed by Mueller's team, and that a bunch are scheduled to happen after the Asia trip, chief among them Hope Hicks, the communications director.
So, Glenn, the White House has totally downplayed George Papadopoulos as being anything other than a low-level aid. Now, how do you interpret that?
Well, it sounds an awful lot like what President Trump has used to describe people who've gotten into trouble around him before. Remember him when he dismissed Steve Bannon, saying, "I haven't known him for all that long." Paul Manafort got his turn in the Trump waiting room, saying that he didn't really know Paul Manafort all that much. You know, the president seems to vacillate between telling everybody, describing everybody as a dear, dear friend, and then saying that he doesn't know who they are. I mean, this is just an established pattern. So it's a classic Trump response. What we know from the factual record is it's somewhere probably on the 50-yard line, right in between these. You know, Trump pulled a piece of paper infamously out of his pocket during a Washington Post edit board meeting in 2016, in which he read Papadopoulos' name off with 4 other foreign policy advisors. But it is clear that Papadopoulos had significant contact with senior members of the campaign team, at least early on. It seems that his influence faded as time went by. He clearly was importuning senior senior campaign officials to facilitate a meeting with Russians and particularly Vladimir Putin. He clearly had access to some information about what was going to be dropped in terms of the emails and shared that with senior members of the campaign team. My reporting a couple of days ago showed that that influence or access to the campaign team fell off a cliff after Manafort left the campaign. And people like Steve Bannon and Hope Hicks, senior campaign officials to the very end, were ignoring his emails by the end of the campaign. And in fact, he made some intemperate comments on BBC about the president and sent out an email to the campaign team asking if they were angry at him. And I don't think anyone bothered. My reporting showed that no one bothered to even respond to him.
But do we have any idea who Papadopoulos told about his contacts with the Russian professor with whom he met?
Again, this is getting a bit fuzzy. There's been some reports that Corey Lewandowski, who was the campaign manager in the early part of the campaign, had some knowledge of that. I don't believe we have confirmed that yet. I think that appeared in the Washington Post. There have been some reporting out there, I believe, by NBC News that Manafort was a senior campaign official who knew about that. Again, I don't think we've been able to completely confirm that. So what is apparent just reading the court papers is that there were at least two people involved, a supervisor and a senior campaign official who had knowledge of it. And I think we do know that Sam Clovis, who played a critical role in assembling Trump's, really, we should say here, very, very small, very inexperienced. It's been described to us as the C team, the policy team, that Sam Clovis certainly had knowledge of this.
And Sam Clovis at the moment is awaiting Senate confirmation for a presidential appointment. And this all will muddy that substantially. But Glenn is absolutely right, and this is not to diminish what George Papadopoulos may or may not have done, because we don't know enough yet. But, you know, I remember when this team was assembled back in March. It was of 2016. It was around the time when David Sanger and I did our first of what would be a series of foreign policy interviews with the president, and now president. And it was all about, you know, sort of putting together the masking tape mask to make it look as if this was real. And the problem with Trump, there's two problems with covering all of this as a reporter, is that one is that he will say that, you know, none of this was really real and none of these people were impressive, and they tell you that they were incredibly impressive and important, and neither one of those things is really true. But he wants them both to be true at any given moment. And then the other thing that's the problem, and I was thinking about this when Glenn was talking about the Washington Post report involving Corey Lewandowski, you know, the problem with ascertaining just a baseline of established and agreed upon facts with Trump for 2.5 years, 3 years, has been that he repeatedly lies, people around him repeatedly lie, and he has a vested interest in making it seem as if there is no independent set of facts, and it really makes reporting on this very tricky.
Well,
Can I just interrupt for a second and tell you, as Maggie was speaking, Diane, I got an email from one of our editors saying that Sam Clovis had withdrawn from.
There you go. Perfect. We're doing this in real time, kids. Let's do it live.
That is really something. And his position was exactly what, Glenn?
He was essentially, well, that's another point to what Maggie was saying, Diane. When you look at the org chart of the Trump campaign, it looks like a jar of dropped marbles rolling all over the place. There are people who are volunteers because they didn't get paid by the campaign, for instance, right? That's why they were volunteers.
Like Paul Manafort.
But Clovis played a central role early on in the campaign in terms of assembling the policy teams. That is very, very clear. So he was, I think his official title was, and Maggie might correct me, was policy director. And he's somebody who, again, had kind of a colorful background. He's a radio personality out in the Midwest, but he is somebody who had some nominal policy chops. And again, his influence, like everyone else's, waxed and waned as the campaign went on.
Interesting. All right. And Maggie, after the indictments came out on Monday, you and Peter Baker apparently had a telephone call with the president. Tell me about that.
Sure. So I had called an aide asking about sort of mood and state of mind because we were preparing a story for yesterday to today about it. And my report, look, I had actually heard from several people that within the White House that actually things were being overstated about how terrible everything was and how they were reacting, how he was reacting. And then the thing about the president is he vents, and there's really no, and then like the storm, he's like a permanent weather system, and the clouds roll in really quick and the clouds roll out really quick, and he's not particularly aware of when he is in a storm himself or creating a storm himself, and how that impacts other people, but he tends not to be in this kind of fixed state, I think, in a way of, you know, sort of King Lear freak out that some reporting has suggested. And I think this was one of those times. He is obsessing about his coverage, but that's what he does always, whether it's about Russia or not. Russia might be a little more acute. But so I had called an aide to ask a question related to this, and I got a call back instead of from the aide, from him. And he clearly
from
wanted to protect
Trump
the president.
Himself.
Sorry, the president.
Okay.
Yes, from him himself. And he clearly wanted to give the impression that, you know, he was fine. You know, that there's nothing to see here. Everything's great. And you know, he kept saying something which we believe, based on, you know, the magic of sight and everything we're seeing, is just not true. That he, you know, he himself is not under investigation. Like, you know, they're looking at obstruction of justice. So. That involves the president. They are looking at what the president knew and when. That involves the president. So that's all fine to say that, but, you know, that is not accurate, and that has been one of his obsessions for a long time. But he kept talking about how he was looking forward to the Asia trip, and that I think is true, based on a lot of people I've talked to who he's spoken with over the last couple of days. He thinks it will be a change. Because he is somebody who has trouble with empathy, and he has somebody who has trouble taking other people's problems into account sometimes. He is looking at this in a very narrow, blinded way as, does this affect me or not me? As opposed to, this is going to take down a lot of people around him, potentially, even if it never touches him personally. And I don't think that's something he has quite processed.
Tell me about the Democratic super lobbyist, Tony Podesta, who stepped down from his firm this week. What does that indicate, Glenn?
Well, that is a really fascinating dynamic here that just kind of, you know, it's funny, Diane, you know, the president obviously ran on the platform of draining the swamp. That was a very late in the campaign addition, I might add. And he may indirectly be doing that with these indictments of dragging these peripheral characters. But Tony Podesta is obviously the brother of John Podesta and is you know, they are close. But they are really polar opposites. John Podesta is this sort of ascetic, monk-like, highly disciplined, whip-thin Clinton associate who is chairman of her campaign and infamously had his emails hacked, on which I got singed a bit. Tony Podesta is this big, larger-than-life K Street lobbyist who has all kinds of business with folks on K Street, and he has come to the investigation grew out of the investigators' examination of Manafort's finances. We are told Manafort had a PR campaign that he organized as part of the money that he got from Ukraine for a nonprofit, and the Podesta Group, which Tony Podesta runs, was one of the firms that did PR work for that. So he's at the moment, he appears to be a peripheral character. But again, he stepped down from his firm. He has said that this was something that he had planned to do in advance. But obviously, that raised all kinds of questions.
So we are back to Paul Manafort. And he has already pled not guilty to everything that's been charged. What has Paul Manafort been charged with?
Paul Manafort has been charged with a range of crimes, but a bunch of them surround essentially money laundering. It doesn't have specifically to do with Russia, and this has been a bone of contention on Twitter over the last couple of days, but what it does relate to is the work that he did for Yanukovych in Ukraine. Remember, there was in 2014 an amazing moment where Yanukovych was taken down and a bunch of papers were found at the bottom of the palace pool with Manafort's name all over them. And it was straight out of a movie. A lot of it relates to that. What else it might relate to, we don't know yet. And I think we have not heard the last of this. My sense, and again, this is tea leaf reading just based on having covered federal court in the past. You know, we know that Rick Gates was represented by a public defender in court the other day, and their charges are interchangeable. I think that they assume that they're not going to be able to get Manafort to cooperate, but I think that they are hoping to get somebody else to cooperate. And basically, the way these indictments were rolled out looked like it was sending a message to anybody in Trump land about the risk of lying or not being forthcoming. And it looked to me as if it was trying to squeeze one of the two people who were indicted.
So you think that Manafort will not turn? He will not give in? He will not talk?
I think you never say never, but I would be surprised unless they offer him a pretty great deal. And I also don't know how much he actually has to offer. I mean, the problem with all of this is it presupposes that there's a ton to offer. We don't actually know what folks have to offer.
Glenn, what do you think these indictments indicate about where the Mueller investigation is going?
I think it's the anaconda approach that a career prosecutor uses. You sort of start squeezing slowly from the outer extremities and work your way forward. It is clear, and in talking with people from the White House, they felt somewhat relieved when the Manafort and Rick Gates indictments came down. They felt that, okay, we can deal with this. This has some distance from the president.
Yeah.
But 90 minutes later, Mueller put out the Papadopoulos indictment, and that changed the tenor entirely. That brought it much closer to them. Two of the three people who were involved in this, let's put Manafort aside. Gates is someone who made an estimated $3 million, according to these indictments. But Gates himself is a much more vulnerable character than Manafort. He's not somebody who has the resources that Manafort had. In fact, he was defended in court by a public defender. And Papadopoulos obviously has been on ice since July. So these are classic. You know, you can almost, again, I'm not likening it to anything particularly, but anybody who's watched Law and Order or seen a procedural in the movie theater knows that you start with the lower level, or The Wire, you know, starts with the lower level folks and you move your way towards the center.
So who do you predict, or looking into your very special bowl, who might be charged next? Glenn?
I think that's a great question for Maggie.
Really? Because I was thinking it was a great question for you. That's so interesting that you think that. I am really hesitant to go there, Diane, only just because I think you can get into a very bad area, and I don't want to wrongly malign somebody if they don't get charged, right? I mean, I think there's a couple of different directions this could go, but I think what Papadopoulos taught us as an indictment and as a guilty plea that did not leak out, that Mueller has a lot of game going on that we're not seeing. So I'm hesitant to try to predict where that goes.
And you, Glenn?
Yeah, and look, what we know from sort of what we've reported and what's been published, right, is that there is there has been Mueller and investigators have been interested in Don Jr.'s meeting with Russians. They are going to speak with Hope Hicks, his communications director, who worked on a statement that the president was involved in crafting in the wake of the Don Jr. revelations. We have heard peripherally that there was some interest in Jared Kushner, though I think that is a little bit more peripheral. You know, I interviewed somebody who had spoken with Mueller's team and said that during that discussion, one of the things that that the people seem to want to know were just attendees at meetings. So that strikes me as being indicative of the fact that Mueller, Mueller is going, we are told that Mueller is going to try to wrap up a lot of this stuff by Thanksgiving, but it is my suspicion that this is going to go on considerably longer.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Mueller will wrap up certain interviews with White House officials, major White House officials in this by Thanksgiving, but I think that's probably all that gets wrapped up by then.
Will the president try to fire Robert Mueller, or will those inside the White House caution him against what that could unleash? Glenn?
What's really interesting about this is the variety of answers that we get to this. We've been told, when Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about this in the briefing this week, her answer was essentially that there are no plans to do that. And the same is holding true for pardons. They say, and we are told at the moment, that there's no intention to do this. But let's reflect back on the firing of James Comey as FBI director. That occurred on a weekend at Bedminster, the president's golf resort, in which he was essentially alone with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who gave him the very questionable political advice Democrats would rally around him for firing Comey because of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. So we're dealing with a president who, despite essentially being leaned on by his in-house legal team, led by Ty Cobb, a white shoe criminal defense attorney of some note here in Washington, he has shown a really impulsive streak. And there is a feeling that if Mueller moves closer to him, remember early on, Jay Sekulow, another member of the president's legal team, implied in a TV interview that a Mueller firing could be possible if Mueller went beyond his brief, looked into the president's financial dealings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've seen a muting of that. Again, he's a wild card president. He's disruptive. He has done things that have surprised us in the past. So who knows is the answer.
Maggie?
No, I agree with that. I agree with everything Glenn said. I think one thing I would add is that, the president has very clearly and very deliberatively kept his option open on this, right? Because he is a completely transactional person who treats everything as if he's in the middle of a negotiation. That's obviously not the case with this. And I think that is what a bunch of his advisors have tried to impress upon him. His former senior strategist, our chief strategist, Steve Bannon, really disagrees with the legal strategy that Ty Cobb is using, which is, completely comply with Mueller and let's get cleared fast. Tom Barrack, who is one of the president's few actual close friends, also disagrees with this strategy, according to my reporting and others' reporting. But the president's not listening. People have said to him, Bannon was really early on this. Bannon was among the people who, at the time he fired Comey, said to him, this is a terrible idea, and was despondent about it. Bannon had said the same thing to him about Mueller repeatedly. What we have heard is that the president's ire is not actually at this moment really focused on Mueller, and I believe that. Just having observed him over time, his anger remains where it was, back in the spring when the Times first reported on this. He's angry at Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, for recusing himself from the probe, and there he remains.
And there's also been news that the president is blaming his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, for all these problems with the Russians. How do you see that, Glenn?
Jared Kushner's status in the White House has diminished really greatly over the past 3 or 4 months. Maggie and I, in the course of doing a retrospective along with our White House team on the first year in office, have just found person after person telling us that Kushner just doesn't seem to be around very much. Much diminished footprint. He did a trip to the Mideast. He's sort of centering around that. I know that John Kelly, the president's chief of staff, has made a point of limiting the kind of walk into the office with your hands in your pockets interactions that Kushner was having with the president. And we also know that the president has been particularly wary of Kushner's political advice. And if you look back, and Maggie knows this better than I do, at the series of political decisions Trump made in consultation with Kushner, a lot of them have just been completely disastrous. I mean, the Paul Manafort hiring was something that was given the blessing of the Trump family. Kushner was part of that. The Comey firing was another one. Kushner has, in general, kind of ginned up his father-in-law to fight back ferociously and not back off at various points in time. And look, the other thing about him is Kushner and Ivanka Trump have a habit of disappearing at critical moments of crisis in the presidency. They were on vacation during the healthcare vote. And we've been told through the course of our reporting that while his relationship remains obviously very close with Ivanka Trump and Jared is his son-in-law, that I think Trump is gradually coming to the realization that Kushner will not be going forward a central part of his team for his entire presidency.
Maggie, anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, I was thinking about the hire of Paul Manafort. I mean, like, look, a simple Google search would have shown that Manafort was going to have enormous problems when they hired him, but vetting has never been these folks' strong suit. It is true that they needed to make a big change at that point, and he was what was available. The week that Manafort was fired, you know, he was not fired primarily by the president because of the Ukraine ties and the reporting that the Times had done about money that he was alleged to have taken. He was fired because of a story that Alex Burns and I did about them treating Trump as if he is a baby, which almost everyone around Trump does and which Trump is aware of but doesn't like to be reminded of.
Maggie, what's that great line? Say that line that Trump said to Manafort. It's just a clap.
It involves an expletive, but it was something to the effect of, and it was in Josh Green's book. We've heard it separately. But the day that the story that Alex and I did came out, Trump summoned Manafort and said, you know, you think I'm a bleeping baby, Paul? Something to that effect. And that week, to Glenn's point, you know, while Trump was railing about Manafort, with whom he never had any chemistry, and Trump is not only a deals guy, but he's a relationships guy. So much of what he does comes down to his personal chemistry with somebody. And he just never had it with Manafort. He did have it with Corey Lewandowski, and that was what he compared it to. But Kushner was trying to hold out to keep Manafort on board pretty aggressively that week. And it was only when the Times reporting came out over successive days that it became clear it was untenable. But Kushner very reluctantly changed his mind. Kushner does not have any kind of political sense, thinks he does, believes that he saved the campaign with their digital operation. The reality is that Donald Trump got himself elected. This was his message. This was not a message that Kushner came up with for him. And he had a lot of lucky factors going into it simultaneously. There is no father of this victory. It just is the way it is.
Help me understand whether John Kelly may be able to restrain the president if he decides to fire Mueller.
Restrain him in what sense? Keep him from doing it, you mean?
Exactly.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, no.
So in
that's a quick answer.
In other words, if he decides to go forward and do that, there's nobody who's going to say, don't do this.
No. That's the misconception here. There are always people who say, don't do that every single time. You know, I mean, for Sean Spicer and I are hardly in lockstep, which my Twitter feed sort of shows. But at the end of the day, to be fair to Spicer, you know, it's not like he was going in, you know, sir, yes, sir, and saluting every single time. He might not have always pushed back as hard as he should have, but he certainly did early on object to a lot of things that he was being ordered to do. There are always lots of voices telling him he shouldn't do it. He will cast around. He will speak to, you know, we've talked to advisors who will say this to us, and I've just observed it myself with him over many years. You know, he'll talk to 40 people who tell him you're doing a terrible thing, and then if he finds the one person who validates what he wants to do, that's what he goes with. So it's not that there aren't
anybody.
It could be the person bringing him a soda.
Exactly.
In the West Wing. Like, it just doesn't matter. And it's not.
Diane, I did a podcast last year when I was at Politico with Colin Yost and Michael Che of Saturday Night Live, and they were telling me about the week that Trump spent around Saturday Night Live. And they said he stayed in the studio longer than any guest that they ever had. He'd sit around in the makeup room, and he'd read this series of printouts of news articles. This is really, it was a telling detail to me. of events of the day. And people would be coming in and out, like other guests on the program, writers, technical people. And he would just be throwing questions at them and asking them and canvassing them as if he had known them forever and asking them their opinions on things. And, you know, that image has been in my mind as I've been covering this White House, because it's exactly the way under the previous chief of staff, Ryan's previous, that he ran the Oval Office. People just wandering in and out.
Wow.
But he needs that. So John Kelly can cut off. It's like an efflux that backs up. You know, he'll put up with a certain vein being sewn up, but then the pressure builds up and it comes out some other way.
You know, here's the thing. You two have been longtime reporters. Have you ever seen any other character who comes close to this kind of personality?
No. Not in politics at this extreme.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think on the History Channel.
Right, exactly.
I think I will say this, though. Like the litmus for our experience, and I think we're lucky to have Maggie and I met as reporters in City Hall in New York working for rival tabloids, right?
True.
What he really resembles more than anything else is a New York political type. There are bits of Ed Koch, the famous loudmouth mayor of New York City, in him. There's a bit of Rudy Giuliani.
Yep.
The scale that he's on a national scale, but there's something really Queens about this guy. And
there's something very parochial.
And one of the things that we kind of came across in the course of our reporting, I think it's fine to talk about it here, is he is fond of kind of talking about this mythical New York City ward healer political boss from his childhood or his early adolescence, you know, because he, as a developer in New York, he had to deal with the Democratic political machine in Queens and Brooklyn. And he talks about this guy in glowing terms, this mythical guy. We can't figure out who it is. It might be Meet Esposito, the famous Brooklyn Democratic leader, who has a bat under his desk. And Trump has told people that's the kind of, you know, essentially, like, that's the kind of guy who can get things done in politics.
And to be clear, like, we actually can't figure out exactly who he's talking about, because there were never reports of Meet Esposito having a bat under his desk. He ruled with an iron fist, but less with a bat. But Trump really believed that, you know, remember, Trump's brain is sort of trapped in the 1980s in New York City. And I was very struck this morning looking again at his tweet, which happened, you know, a night earlier about bringing back the death penalty, or not bringing back the death penalty. Sorry, he said give the death penalty to the man accused of the terrorist attack in Lower Manhattan the other day.
Yes.
Which was, you know, on its face, a million times problematic for the people who will be prosecuting this case, and who may actually, you know, invoke some tough penalty and try for it. And this will be seen potentially as prejudicial. But when I looked at it, the all-caps death penalty, I was reminded of this 1989 ad that Donald Trump took out, full-page ad, I believe it was in the New York Times, bring back the death penalty. And it was days after five teenagers, four black, one Hispanic, were arrested and charged with a quote-unquote wilding against a woman jogger in Central Park, became known famously as the Central Park jogger case. Those young men were wrongly charged. They were exonerated based on DNA later. Yep. But Trump moved ahead within days and did bring back the death penalty.
Wow.
Nothing has changed in his mind since then. Nothing. And if you look at the two institutions that he came up dealing with in media and in government, the city hall that he dealt with to get permits to build the Wallman Rink in Central Park, which he talks about all the time. It was really interesting hearing him talk about it in Iowa during the campaign. It was Ed Koch's city hall was fundamentally corrupt, and that has been covered at length over many, many decades. The tabloid that he dealt with the most, the newspaper that he dealt with the most, was the New York Post. And the New York Post, I revere and love. I began my career there. It gave me my life in a lot of ways. But it was a transactional place that had a deep relationship with Trump, where he could call up and place a story about himself on a blind, where he rated his day based on the kind of coverage he got there. And that is his mindset. He sees the media and the government as fundamentally tainted in some way. And that is a lot of what you see in terms of his behavior.
Okay, we'll let it go at that. Thank you both so much for joining me.
It was our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Joining me now is Lauren Brooke Eisen. She's senior counsel at the Brennan Center's Justice Program at New York University's School of Law. She's just written a book called Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Lauren Brooke Eisen, it's so good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Tell me first about private prisons and just how prevalent they are.
So private prisons are very prevalent in this country, about 9% at the state level and close to 20% at the federal level. But something that most people are not aware of when it comes to these private prison companies is that they have about 3/4 of the market share in these immigrant detention centers. And these are, for all intents and purposes, prisons where undocumented citizens spend days, if not months, and years of their lives.
Take us back to when these first private prisons came into operation on a grand scale.
Well, what happened was in the 1980s, almost half, in fact, more than half of the states were under some sort of federal court order to reduce their prison populations due to unconstitutional practices, unhygienic conditions. And states didn't know what to do. It's very expensive to build new prisons. It's very complicated and difficult to start downsizing your prison population. So these private corporations stepped in to fill a void. And they marketed themselves as government partners who could build these facilities quickly, more efficiently, and without raising, you know, taxpayer bonds. And departments of corrections and governments started to rely on them to send their populations to these new prisons without having to build their own. And that's really how they started. Since the 1980s, these corporations have really started to increase their market share.
However, as I understand it, the Obama administration issued directives to reduce and ultimately end our reliance on private prisons. But now, President Trump has reversed that order.
That's exactly right. The Attorney General, Sally Yates, under the Obama administration, issued a memo to the Bureau of Prisons asking them to reduce their reliance on these private prisons. In fact, Attorney General Yates wrote in her memo that these prisons simply do not provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources. What happened under the Trump administration is that Attorney General Sessions, in a one-paragraph memo to the Bureau of Prisons, reversed that Obama-era guidance. That's a harbinger of things to come and very indicative of how the current administration feels about the privatization of criminal justice.
So at this point, you have how many of these private systems across the country as compared to how many federally operated prison systems across the country?
Well, there are private prison facilities across 29 states and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. how that works is that government contracts with these private prison corporations. So it's up to every Department of Corrections or these counties to engage in these contracts. The federal government has its own contracts. Right now, they have about 12 contracts with the federal government. Additionally, there are a couple of requests for proposals out on their website for corporations to propose building new detention centers as well.
In your new book, Inside Private Prisons, you call it an American dilemma in the age of mass incarceration. How many different prisons did you actually visit?
In the research for this book, I visited prisons in New Mexico, Colorado, and immigration detention centers that were privatized in Texas. I also spoke to dozens of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated individuals and their families, most of whom had experiences with private prisons and private detention centers. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book is there's so many questions about how these corporations run and operate prisons that most people aren't aware of or don't think about. And I wanted to ask, what does it mean for a for-profit company to manage jails and prisons? Is it legal to delegate this responsibility? If it is legal, is it responsible? Is it moral? So these are the questions that I explored by interviewing incarcerated individuals who were in these facilities, undocumented citizens in these detention centers. Additionally, I emailed a lot of incarcerated individuals who were spending time in private prisons and spoke with many on the phone.
So give us an idea how these private prisons differ from those run by the government in terms of, you know, what life is like for those incarcerated.
In terms of the outcomes and the differences, these facilities tend to have a little bit less programming than their government counterparts. Part of that is because one of the reasons government contracts with these facilities is for cost savings. So at the end of the day, these corporations have to find cost savings somewhere. And they do that in terms of their correctional staff and in terms of the programming they offer.
What does that programming normally include?
There tends to be job training and educational programming and rehabilitative programming, such as drug treatment. These private facilities also have programming, but they tend to not have as much. The contracts don't require such robust programming, and that's one of the recommendations I make in the book. We really need to hold these corporations' feet to the fire more than we've been doing for four decades.
You know, I thought when these private prisons first began that there was a promise that they would provide a better environment, that there would be better facilities, that it would not be quite so restrictive, that it would really be different. What you're saying is that the private companies are offering actually less.
That's exactly right. And when these companies entered the scene in the 1980s, they promised innovative practices. They promised they were a government partner to improve conditions of confinement. And some of these facilities may not look that different from their government counterparts. You know, there's some government prisons and jails, such as Rikers Island, where there are terrible conditions of confinement. There are sexual assaults, you know, daily. So this isn't necessarily a private prison versus a government prison issue in terms of conditions of confinement. But I think the question that needs to be asked, and something that I explore in the book, is where is this innovation? We are paying private corporations a lot of money for this government service, and we haven't seen them do anything that government's not doing. Their recidivism rates are no different from recidivism rates at government facilities. And that's a big problem. If the CEOs are going to take home big paychecks, we need to see better recidivism rates and better outcomes than what we're seeing in their government counterparts.
What about the communities in which these private prisons operate? Are they, for example, being given more jobs? Is there an uptick in the economy in those areas?
That's something that I explore in the book as well, is the lure of private prisons to rural towns in America. And I visited a town, Appleton, Minnesota, who has had a long history with a prison that they built in their town to increase the economic viability. Right now, the prison sits empty. It's owned by CoreCivic. And I interviewed the mayor of the town. I interviewed the county commissioner who brought the prison to the town a couple of decades ago. And the town of Appleton, is similar to many towns across the country, is hoping that the prison will open its doors this year. They need the revenue for its tax base. They want restaurants to open again. You know, the town right now is devastated because the prison closed. And there are towns like Appleton, Minnesota, that dot the American landscape. Another similar story in Hardin, Montana. Right now, we see this playing out in Encinal, New Mexico, where a CoreCivic prison is about to close. And the people who live in that town really depend on it for its economy.
So how come they're closing? Is the prison population going down in this country? And are those towns where the prisons have been built hoping that those who are going to be arrested for export back to their native countries, are they hoping that they're going to go into those prisons?
So about half the states in this country, a little more than half the states, have started to reduce their state prison population. And that's why some of these prisons are closing. In fact, CoreCivic and GEO Group, the country's two largest private prison corporations, have started to read the tea leaves and are diversifying and are getting involved in community corrections, halfway houses, treatment. Additionally, they're diversifying overseas in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand because they are worried that states are starting to reduce their prison populations. While policymakers who are focused on criminal justice reform continue to work on reducing these prison populations, I interviewed a lot of people in these towns who are dependent on these prisons. And they're not thinking about criminal justice reform. They're not thinking about mass incarceration. They're thinking about jobs, and they're thinking about the tax revenue of their town and the money that the local schools need based on the revenue that these prisons are bringing in.
And did those prisons, while they were open, bring in huge amounts of revenue and taxes?
Well, that's an excellent question. And that's something that a lot of academics and researchers continue to study today. The consensus on most of the research so far is that there are short-term gains in terms of economic revenue. And that was played out in this town of Appleton, Minnesota. Once the prison was built, a Super 8 motel opened its doors, and the town fixed its airport and added a couple of runways and two new restaurants and a pizza shop and a gas station opened their doors. And the town started to see more revenue, more jobs. Once the prison closed, it devastated the community. And I drove around the town. You know, today there's one gas station, there's one coffee shop, there's one restaurant. And that's the sad story of what it means to lure these prisons into a town. And it's just like any other industry. But the reason why this is so different is this isn't, you know, building a Kmart or a Walmart in your town. This is depending on mass incarceration for the economic viability of your town. And that's very different.
And tell me about accountability and transparency.
One of the findings of my book is that the differences between government-run and private prisons is that the private prisons suffer from a significant lack of transparency and accountability. And what I mean by that is that there are problems in jails and prisons across the country, whether you are in a state prison, a state jail, a federally operated, governmentally run prison, or a private prison. They all have their shares of escapes and riots and sexual assaults. But the real problem with these private corporations running prisons is that they are not subject to the same government transparency requirements. They are not required to turn over records.
So are you advocating for the closing of these private prisons?
Under the Trump administration, we are starting to see more of a reliance on private prisons. And in the book, I do suggest reforms. I suggest many recommendations to improve transparency and accountability in these private prisons. I also recommend changing contracts, rewriting these contracts with these private prisons so that we can reduce recidivism rates, so that these corporations are fined much more than they're being fined today for not complying with their contracts and with performance standards. But it's also a human story. Even with all of these recommendations, even if we change these outcomes and these performance measures, what does it mean about American justice that the profit motive is such a big part of the justice system?
Lauren Brooke Eisen, I want to thank you so much for shedding light on a system that I think most Americans know very little about. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. That number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced this week by Allison Brody and Lisa Dunn. Our engineers are Timothy Olmsted and Jake Cherry. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.